Welcome to the Holidays to Switzerland Travel Podcast. Your host is the founder of holidaystoswitzerland.com and the Switzerland Travel Planning Facebook group, Carolyn Schonefinger. On this podcast, Carolyn will be joined by a variety of guests who share their knowledge and love of the country to help you plan your dream trip to Switzerland.
Grüezi, and welcome to episode 32 of the Holidays to Switzerland podcast. As an avid reader and a lover of all things Swiss, I'm always looking for books about Switzerland, and there really aren't a lot available, in English at least. If Italy or France are your European destination of choice, you'll find hundreds and probably thousands of both fiction and non-fiction books to choose from. But for Switzerland, it's a little bit more difficult. So when I stumbled across a book called Slow Train to Switzerland, the story of a reenactment, if you like, of the very first package tour to Switzerland in 1863, I was intrigued. I purchased the book and was fascinated by both the similarities and the differences between travelling in Switzerland today and back then, almost 160 years ago. Googling the name of the author, Dicken Bues, I discovered that he lives in Bern and is the author of 7 books on Switzerland. He is also a wealth of knowledge when it comes to Switzerland. Ask him about Swiss history, chocolate, watches, famous Swiss residents, or practically any topic related to Switzerland, and there's a fair chance Dicken will know the answer. Dicken has kindly agreed to come on the show today to tell us about his books and to share his top tips for visiting his home city of Bern. Even if you're not an avid reader like me, I'm sure you'll find Dicken's knowledge of Switzerland and his insider tips really helpful. Thanks for joining me on the podcast, Dicken. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for inviting me. It's great to have a little connection with Australia.
Wonderful. Now, the bio on your website says that you're a travel writer, a chocolate lover, and an Englishman in Bern, which sounds like a wonderful combination of talents to have. So I'm really keen to hear your story and how you came to be writing books about Switzerland.
It was accidental, really. I didn't move to Switzerland with the intention of writing books about this lovely country. So I grew up in England, as you can probably hear from my voice. Although I am now Swiss, I am still British. And I was a travel writer in the UK for a travel magazine. So I was a staff writer. They would send me places. I would go for anything from 4 days to 4 weeks, depending on the place, go back and write about it. And that was my life for about 10 years. And it was fun. I loved it. But you have no life, really, because you're traveling all the time. And so I decided to give it up when I met my boyfriend, who is Swiss, who lives here in Bern. And I moved over here 16 years ago with nothing really in mind other than let's live in a new country and learn a new language and see what happens. And I got a job in a bookshop here in Bern, an English language bookshop, became the manager, and kind of realized that firstly, I missed writing and my German in those days wasn't good enough to write in German. And also the books about Switzerland in English weren't what I wanted to read about Switzerland. So I took this kind of leap of faith, I guess you would say, and decided to write something for myself the first time I'd done that, rather than writing for my employer. And I wrote a chapter about traveling around Switzerland looking for Heidi, because I'm sure you know Heidi is not real. She is fictional, even though lots of people believe she is real and you're looking for her. And that chapter got me an agent who got me a publisher who gave me a contract, and suddenly I had to write a book. And that was my first book, Swiss Watching, which was 11 years ago. And so it's a sort of natural extension of what I did in my previous life, but much more focused on my new home rather than traveling around the world and writing about it.
Yeah, oh, wonderful. Now, you mentioned there that when you first started working in the bookshop and writing, your German wasn't great. So obviously, I guess you've learnt that since you've been in Bern.
Yes, and some people probably would say my German still isn't great because it's a second language and not my first language.
Yeah, sure. But do you think that was sort of an essential ingredient for helping you to integrate into the community, being able to speak German?
For me, it was essential. I mean, I literally enrolled in German school within a week of moving here and started from the beginning with der, die, das and all the horrible grammar that German has. And I think for me, it was a crucial part. One, because my boyfriend's family speak almost no English, and so I had to learn to communicate with them. But also because if you want to go shopping or just meet your neighbors, then it's really hard if you're expecting everyone to speak English. And obviously, a lot of Swiss people speak really good English. Otherwise, my books wouldn't sell well here. But I think it's a little bit an English language mentality. It's like, oh, you expect everyone else to speak English. It's not like we speak Norwegian, and so we'll never find another Norwegian speaker. We just assume that people will understand us. It's a little bit arrogant, I feel. And what's interesting for me is since the books came out, I've done hundreds of events all across Switzerland. Before the pandemic, I used to have one a week somewhere in Switzerland, talking to expats or people who had moved over just for a couple of years to work for one of the pharmaceutical companies, or people who have lived here for 20 years and still haven't learned the language. And Switzerland has four national languages. You can choose from any one of the four, depending on where you live. And they're the ones who feel a little bit isolated and a little bit unintegrated, and also that Swiss people are a little bit unfriendly. And I always say to them, I said, you have to make a bit of effort. You are the newcomer in the country for your own peace of mind and your own well-being, let alone talking to your co-workers or your neighbors or the other mothers at school or whatever. So my suggestion always to everyone I meet who's a foreigner in Switzerland is learn the language to whatever degree you feel comfortable, but at least learn how to say hello and ask for things in the market. And to me, it made a huge difference. As soon as I could speak German well enough, I got the job in the bookshop, because even though it was an English bookshop, I had to be able to speak German to serve customers. And also just interacting with friends and neighbors and watching the television so you could understand the Swiss news and the Swiss weather. And I think it makes a huge difference to your quality of life.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure it does. So Swiss Watching was your first book, and you've now got 7 books published, I believe. So we're going to chat more about Slow Train to Switzerland in a moment, because that's the one that I've read. But can you tell us about the other books and sort of what inspired each of them?
So let's start at the beginning with Swiss Watching, which is a very general book about Switzerland, explaining how it became the way it is. So looking at every aspect of life in Switzerland, whether that's history and geography and politics, or whether it's cheese, chocolate and trains, and obviously Heidi, the Heidi chapter is in there. And a lot of personal experiences from me living here as a foreigner and trying to find my way with the language, with etiquette, with finding a job and all that sort of stuff. So it's a kind of overview of Switzerland, a biography of the country, but from a very personal point of view, an outsider looking on the inside. And of course, it's very informative and very funny, which is why it became a bestseller. I was very lucky that my first book became a bestseller in Switzerland, even before it was translated into French and German, and also became Financial Times Book of the Year in the UK.
Fantastic. Well done.
So that, yeah, it was a good start. And then it's been downhill ever since. Luckily for me, there seems to be an unlimited number of ways I can look at Switzerland. All my books are about Switzerland. So the second one, which we'll talk about in a minute, is Slow Train to Switzerland. Then came a real labor of love. It took 2 years to put together. It's called Around Switzerland in 80 Maps. And it uses old maps right through to current maps to explain the story of Switzerland, how it got its current shape and borders, but also looking at how transport developed, military maps, statistical maps. And I found them all in archives all around Switzerland. It was 2 years' work. But it's beautiful, a big coffee table book, weighs 2 kilos, but luckily sold really well because no one had ever looked at Switzerland using maps before. Then the little book of cartoons that was just a bit of fun that I did with a Swiss friend of mine who's a cartoonist, called How to Be Swiss, just looking at aspects of Swiss life and how foreigners kind of find the foibles a bit difficult to understand. During the pandemic, which was a really bad time to bring out a new book, there was a book called The Expert Guide to Living in Switzerland. So it's literally advice for people who are moving here or have just moved here. Everything from visas and health insurance and buying a house to kindergarten and day trips out. And so just trying to give people the advice that I needed when I moved here. Mm-hmm. And then the last two books, which were published this week, you can tell I've had a busy pandemic. I've been sitting at home writing. There's a really beautiful photographic souvenir book or a bucket list book called Swiss 52, which is my 52 favorite places in Switzerland. From the obvious, like Lucerne or the Matterhorn, to smaller villages, which even people living here might not have heard of, but I think are beautiful. And the last one is another big book, but this time for children. It's a children's atlas of Switzerland called Cartographica Helvetica. Comes in three different languages, and it explains Switzerland to 8 to 12-year-olds using maps and infographics. Lots of bite-sized pieces of information, very colorful, big format, so that especially children moving here or living here with foreign parents, it can be even harder for them because even if they're 9, 10, they know what's going on, but they're suddenly in a different country with a different language. And so we decided to create a book that could explain Switzerland to them in terms that they would understand, like what we eat or the trees and the flowers, but also a bit of history and tackling more difficult subjects like women's rights or neutrality so that they can see why Switzerland is different from the country they came from.
Yeah.
So they're the books that I've done so far.
Wow, there's definitely something for everyone there, isn't there?
Well, I hope so. I have to try and keep everyone happy.
Now, and are there any more in the works? Have you got any more ideas or?
Yes, some ideas, but I think it's now been three books in the last 2 years. So I think I'm just going to take a little break over the winter and see what happens.
Yeah, good, good. Okay, so let's talk about Slow Train to Switzerland. I'm not actually sure where I came across it, but when I read the blurb, I thought, oh, this sounds really interesting. So I bought it on and read it on my Kindle, and I've actually read it a couple of times because I just really like how it relates to the things that tourists do today. But can you tell all our listeners what the book is about and how it actually came about in the first place?
Well, let's start with how it came about. When I was researching Swiss watching, which hopefully you remember is my first book, I didn't speak much German, and I basically latched onto anything in English that could help me understand Switzerland, and there wasn't a lot around. So I even read travel guides as my background as a travel writer. And in one of the travel guides, there was a list of books to read at the back, and it mentioned this book called Miss Jemima's Swiss Journal. And I thought, I'd never heard of that. And I Googled it, thanks to the internet. I found a copy in a secondhand bookshop and ordered it. And it was a diary of a woman who went on a tour of Switzerland in 1863. I mean, it's not a famous travel diary. She wasn't Bridget Jones. She didn't find worldwide fame. It kind of disappeared without trace. And the edition I had was published briefly for the 100th anniversary in 1963. And then again, it disappeared. And it turned, I read it, and it was useful background research for Swiss watching. And then when my publisher said, right, we need a second book now that Swiss watching is a bestseller. And I said, well, I've got this weird idea. Back in 1863, this woman from Yorkshire went on a tour of Switzerland with Thomas Cook, who was a real person, not just a travel agent. And she wrote a diary. So I'm going to take the diary and follow exactly the same route. And it's perfect timing because in 2013 will be the 150th anniversary of this journey. So that's how it came about. It was a very simple idea. So I took her diary, recreated the journey. I didn't do it to every detail. There was a time when we thought I would dress up in costume and do it like she did. But then I realized she was wearing crinoline cages and the whole Gone with the Wind look, which isn't my look at all, really. And also, actually, when I started researching around the story of that first tour, it actually became part of the book for me was showing what that tour led to in terms of tourism and development in Switzerland. And so then it was much more logical that I do the tour in a modern day version, exactly the same route, but to show, for instance, when they went from Chamonix in France to Martigny in Switzerland, they rode a donkey or hiked through the Alps because there were no trains. And yet I could take a train and it took an hour instead of a day. But that train was built precisely because tourism became so big. And so the Swiss and the British wanted to develop infrastructure for all the tourists who are coming. And so that was part of the story. So thank goodness we dropped the doing it in costume, riding a donkey through the Alps. And really, it was fascinating for me because this was the first ever package tour abroad for British people. Thomas Cook was a household name already. Sadly, Thomas Cook is now bankrupt. But in the 1850s, he made his name with excursions within Britain, such as taking people up to the Great Exhibition in London or weekends in Scotland. But it didn't work for him. He wasn't making money. He was on the verge of going bankrupt. And so he needed a new idea, and he looked to Switzerland. He had never been here, but Switzerland was this kind of utopia of not very industrialized, beautiful landscape, and had already been eulogized by Wordsworth and various other writers, Byron, et cetera, et cetera. And he made an expedition to Paris and discovered that the train line between Paris and Geneva was complete. And so this gave him the idea of selling tickets, group tickets, to make it cheaper, on the trains to make it faster. Because up until then, you had to be Lord Byron or Charles Dickens to get to Switzerland. It took 2 weeks in a horse and carriage. You had to have your own money. It wasn't something for the middle classes. And Britain had a new middle class because of the Industrial Revolution. There were teachers, doctors, lawyers who got holiday each year and wanted to start exploring. And Thomas Cook was the right man at the right time, and he started these tours. He actually had no idea what he was doing. He was just really lucky to be there. He had no plan. He didn't know where they were going to stay. He didn't know how they were going to get around, because he didn't know that in Switzerland there were very few trains, et cetera, et cetera. But it worked. And that first tour was 3 weeks from London to Luzern and back. Thomas Cook actually left them after a week because he had to go back to London and save his company. So they were on a guided tour without a guide for much of the time. But it was a success, and Miss Jemima was part of that first group. She traveled with her brother and two friends, and her day-to-day descriptions of Switzerland are fascinating in a way, because part of it hasn't changed at all. She describes the mountains and the glaciers and the valleys, and it could be what we're looking at today. And then the other part is 180 degrees from what we know in terms of poverty, and because Switzerland was very poor before tourism. And she talks about walking through villages with barefoot children and women begging in the streets, or men offering to carry their bags to earn a few centimes. And it just doesn't feel like Switzerland we know today. And so that for me became really the big story. Yes, it was great to follow in her footsteps and have twin travelogues and to travel back in time a little bit. And you could see how basic it was. There were no indoor bathrooms, no toilets on the trains. And they really were pioneers in a way. And they were hiking through mountains for 11 hours a day in tight corsets and big dresses and 30 degree heat. So it wasn't comfortable at all.
No.
But the fascinating thing for me is, after the tour ended, which in theory is where my book ended, I then looked at what happened afterwards. And this explosion of tourism, the first mass tourist destination was Switzerland. And so within 50 years, right up to the First World War, you have hotels being built, train lines, paddle steamers, everything for the British tourists who came in their thousands. Thomas Cook very quickly became the world's first travel agent, invented traveler's checks, invented rail passes, all this sort of stuff we take for granted, all started in Switzerland. So any tourist today or traveler today has to be thankful for what Thomas Cook did in Switzerland 150 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And a couple of the things that I found really fascinating about the book, obviously, as you mentioned, they did this trip in 1863, which was nearly 160 years ago. So a couple of episodes ago, I interviewed Frederick, the CEO of Mount Rigi Railways, which is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. But Miss Jemima and her party, they actually went up Mount Rigi, but they had to be carried up
a sedan chair. Well, actually, they couldn't afford to be carried up, because if you're carried up, you need generally three porters, because you're going uphill, so it's quite hard work. So Queen Victoria was carried up in a sedan chair. But Miss Jemima and her friends, they couldn't afford that. So they walked up, but they employed a carrier to carry their luggage.
Right, yeah.
So that's the hard bit if you're walking up with a portmanteau and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, they walked up and it was at the end of a long day. They'd already been traveling halfway across Switzerland by carriage and boat by the time they got to the foot of Rigi. And then they walked up because the thing to do in those days was to stay overnight in Rigi and then get up and watch the sunrise across the lakes and the Alps. It was the big tourist attraction. And it carried on being the big tourist attraction, which is why Europe's first mountain train was built in 1871 to take people up Rigi, because it was the biggest thing you could possibly imagine to do in Switzerland at the time. These days, I mean, I did it. Obviously, I stayed overnight and watched the sunrise, but I was on my own. Whereas when she did it, there were 200 people there. Even before mass tourism, by the time you get to the First World War, Mount Rigi could house 2,000 people every night because there were so many hotels and so many people going using the train that it just became tourist central. And then the First World War killed all that, and Mount Rigi never recovered. I mean, today it's a nice day out, but very few people stay overnight.
Yeah.
But yes, they did rough it in a way, but in another way, it was quite... gentle's the wrong word. It was quite amenable travel. They weren't dashing around the way we feel that tour groups are today. It was slow travel. They took their time. They had to. They couldn't dash around. And so that's one thing I learned from the book as well. Although their experience was actually quite uncomfortable in terms of they didn't have a bath for the whole time. There were no baths. So they just sort of had a splash of water on the face and under the arms type thing. But they changed for dinner each day, as was the style in Victorian Britain. And so it wasn't all slumming it. And they went to church every Sunday because there were English services already in Switzerland in those days. And so it was kind of this interesting mix, especially looking back for us when, I mean, we can wear a T-shirt every day for a week and never change for dinner and no one really cares.
Yeah.
But looking back, they were traveling, it was uncomfortable, it was challenging, and yet they still had certain standards.
One thing they didn't have, though, was chocolate, because their trip was 12 years before the invention of milk chocolate, so I learnt in your book.
Yes, and they'd never heard of Heidi, because Heidi came 25 years later. They had never seen a Swiss Army knife, because that came 35 years later. And so all the clichés we have about Switzerland really weren't there for her. She didn't know what she was missing. Obviously, she'd never eaten milk chocolate in her life, but I'm sure she would have enjoyed it. But they did. Her brother bought a watch as a souvenir. And of course, they tried the cheese, because Switzerland's been famous for cheese for centuries. So a couple of the things that we take for granted for Switzerland were there, but quite a few of them came later, and partly thanks to tourism, because what tourism did in Switzerland, it wasn't the only generator of the economy, but it made the Switzerland much smaller, because train lines were built for all these lazy British tourists who wanted to get round in a hurry. The Swiss people generally couldn't afford to take train rides. They were very expensive. So it cost a week's wages just to go 3 hours on the train. But the fact that train lines were built meant that the country was geographically united, so that fruit growers in the south could get their fruit to the big cities in the north in one day instead of 1 week. And so it transformed Switzerland completely. And so the knock-on effect meant that lots and lots of different things were invented, and Switzerland became quite industrial, and that led to the economy we have today. But the sort of the seed of all of that was mass tourism.
Thank you, Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Yes, indeed. And yes, today with pandemic, we have an interesting discussion here in Switzerland, but in other countries as well. How much do we depend on tourism? Because we've seen what it's like without it. And before the pandemic, everyone was talking about over-tourism and the Alps being too crowded and too many tour groups. Then it all stopped completely. And now we've had to see, well, look how many jobs depend on it, especially in the Alpine areas. Mm-hmm. So where do we find the balance? And I think it's the first time that we've had that discussion in any country since the Second World War, at least, because it's just been boom, boom, boom in terms of tourism. cheap flights, tour groups, et cetera, et cetera. And now we're kind of resetting and trying to work out where the balance is. So again, I think that's an interesting look back. The same happened with the First World War. There was this 50-year boom, and people in just before the First World War, again, were talking about over-tourism because they wanted to build trains up every mountain there was, and it was ruining the environment. And aside the fact that they thought actually that it would be harmful to women if they traveled by train too much because their internal organs would be displaced. That's not a debate we have today. But the First World War put a stop to it, and it took a long time to recover, obviously, because of then the recession, the depression, et cetera, et cetera. But they had the same sort of discussion. It's like, what do we want? We need tourism. It's the motor of the economy. It employs thousands of people, even sort of just the person running the souvenir shop in Lucerne or whatever. But is it too much? At what point does it get too much? And Thomas Cook started that whole boom, which lasted 50 years, and now we're resetting again so we can see where we go from here.
Yeah. Interesting times. So yeah. Where can we find copies of all your books if we'd like to buy them? As I said, I bought The Slow Train to Switzerland from Amazon to download on my Kindle, but are books available elsewhere?
Yes, certainly the first two books are available pretty much everywhere because they're published by Hachette, one of the world's largest publishers. So Swiss Watching, Slow Train to Switzerland, both in paperback, in a real book, or on Kindle, or on any other ebook version there is. But you can also order them direct. So the Book Depository, for instance, is a great book website I'm sure you know about with free shipping worldwide. Obviously Amazon, but also online versions. The other books are all published in Switzerland. So all the other ones I mentioned are a Swiss publisher. They can be found on Amazon, or you can order them direct from my publisher, which is Helvetique, in Switzerland. If you, it's easy to Google them and it comes up, and they will ship worldwide as well. Okay. With relatively low shipping costs because, especially if you order two or three books together. So they're all quite easy to find online. Actually, in America, in Britain, in Australia, then the two paperbacks you can find easily in any bookshop, or the bookshop can order it for you.
Okay, great. Well, I'll put links to those supplies that you mentioned in the show notes for the episode too. So that if listeners want to grab a copy, they can just click through and do that. All right, so you've made Bern your home. So I'm really keen to get your tips for people that are visiting Bern for the first time. What are the things that you think are essential that they should see and do in the city?
Oh, well, I think the first thing is to manage your expectations. Bern's a small city. It's 130,000 people. The city centre is very compact. You can walk around it in an hour or so. But that's part of its charm. It's not a big world city, even though it's the capital of Switzerland and it's right in the center of the country. So it's actually a good base for exploring the rest of the country. You're 1 hour to Zurich, you're 1 hour to the Bernese Alps, you're even just 1 hour to Germany or Italy. But the city itself, it burnt down in 1405, and then the street plan hasn't changed much. And it's the whole city is UNESCO Heritage Site, all built from this local green sandstone. And it's beautiful. It has arcades. It has cobbled streets and squares. It has this medieval street plan, has the tallest cathedral in Switzerland. And it's surrounded on three sides by the River Aare, which is Switzerland's longest river. So it has this sort of compact, almost time capsule feel to it, but it's a living, working city. I live here, and it's not a living museum. So it's that nice combination of being authentic, but also traditional and real. And the main attractions, I would say, obviously the cathedral, which is it's very Calvinist. It's very plain inside, but outside it's a beautiful Gothic building. And you can climb up the spire and get this amazing view of the old town with all its red roofs and then the snowy Alps on the horizon. So you can see the Alps from the city center. We're that close to them. The other thing I would suggest would be the Saturday market, which takes place in front of Parliament. Bern has federal parliament. And yet because it's a living, working city, it's not like Westminster Square in, or Parliament Square in Westminster in London, where nothing really happens apart from demonstrations and buses. Here, we have a market every Saturday, a farmer's market. There's also an ice rink in winter. There's beach volleyball in summer. There's the national Christmas tree at Christmas. And so it's the center of Swiss politics, but it's also the center of Bernie's life. And the Saturday market is really lovely to look around. And if you come in summer, one of the best things to do is you can swim round the city in the river. So Bern doesn't have a lake, unlike Zurich or Geneva. Instead, we swim in the river, which I think is much more fun because a lake doesn't move. It's basically a giant bathtub, whereas the river moves. And you don't actually have to swim. The Aare is relatively fast, so I would say only do it if you're a good swimmer. You can just float, and the river takes you around the whole city under all the bridges, and you can see the city from the river. And it's a lovely way to cool down. Again, because we don't have a lake, Bern can get quite warm in the summer. Over 30 degrees is fairly typical now. And when you're getting 35, 36 day after day, then you jump in the river. And the river's never warmer than about 22, 23 because the water's coming straight from the Alps. So it's quite refreshing. But actually spending an hour in the water is a lovely way to spend a summer day in Bern.
Sounds lovely. Now, I know a lot of people will have seen on Instagram and all the different social media photos from the Rosengarten, views looking back over the bridge and back over the old town. So that garden, as well as roses, it's quite famous for its other floral displays in other seasons too, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, it has like 200 different types of roses, but there are also many other flowers. So in spring, there are hosts of daffodils. And it used to be the city cemetery, which is a lot of people forget. The city outgrew it, so they built a new cemetery on the outskirts of town and turned the cemetery into a rose garden. But it is the best view. You can get up there by bus or you can just walk up. And you see the whole of the loop of the Aare with the red roofs of the old town and the spire of the cathedral and the dome of Parliament. It's a beautiful view. Especially, I think it's lovely in the morning because then the sun's kind of behind you shining on the old town, but it's also lovely in the evening with the sunset. And then if you walk down the hill from the Rosengarten towards the city itself, you come to the Bear Garden. Mm-hmm. And Bern is famous for its family of bears. At the moment it's a bit like Goldilocks. We have a mummy bear, a daddy bear, and a baby bear. And they live they have quite a big garden with a stretch of river for them to swim in. And they live there all year round. Obviously, they hibernate October to Easter, roughly. So you won't see them if you come in the winter. But if you come in the summer, they're always either lying in the sun or swimming or wandering around munching some grass. And Bern is actually named after bears. So Bären in German means bears. And it got shortened to Bern. They're the symbol of the city. You see bears everywhere on the flag. There are statues of bears all around the fountains. And the legend is if there are never any bears in Switzerland, or if there are ever no bears in Switzerland, the city will fall to dust. So there have been bears in Bern now for about 600 years. Mm. Not the same bears.
Better keep them there.
Better keep them there, yeah.
Now, one thing we haven't mentioned is the astronomical clock, which is quite famous.
Yes, you see, there's so much to see in Bern. I forgot about one of the most famous sites. The Zitglocke, or clock tower, dates from 1527, and it's still the same clock with all the original working parts, and everything is inside is wood, and it also has moving wooden figures on the outside. Now, it's not Las Vegas. It's 500 years old, so when I'm showing visitors around, especially Americans, I say, just remember, this is an old lady. She's almost 500 years old. No fireworks, no bells and whistles, but on the hour, it chimes and everything moves. And the clock itself is quite large, and it shows you everything you need to know. So not just the time, but also day of the week, month of the year, star sign, phase of the moon, etc., all on one clock with lots of different dials. It's quite fascinating to watch, and it's beautiful. It's just been restored, so it's all been regilded again, so it really looks spectacular on a sunny day when everything's shining in the sun.
Okay, good time to go and see it.
Yeah.
Now, what about events? Are there any events throughout the year that non-locals may not know about that you think are worth experiencing?
My favourite event in Bern is hopefully just coming up. We had to cancel it last year for obvious reasons. All events were cancelled. But at the end of November, you get what is called the Zwiebelmarkt or the Onion Market. And it's the Bernese version of Thanksgiving. And it's all focused on onions. So tons and tons of onions are brought into the city and you can buy them in every shape or form, whether they're platted or whether they're, so you have onions made up as people with faces drawn on them and little legs. But also you get onion soup, onion tart, onion bread, onion everything. It starts at 4 a.m. I'm never there at 4 a.m. I usually go mid-morning and it lasts all day. And the whole of the city center is full of market stalls and thousands of people. And the most interesting aspect, I think, is confetti. You can buy giant bags of confetti, literally like popcorn-sized bags and bigger, and then everyone throws confetti at each other all day. So you come home, and even if you brush it off, you take off your coat because it's November, obviously you're wearing a coat, and then all this confetti falls out from inside your sleeves and everything. So it's kind of fun. It's one of the few times of the year that the Bernese really let their hair down. The other time is at the other end of winter for Carnival. So it's not as big as Carnival in Basel, let alone Rio. It's quite a small, sedate, gentle Carnival, just like Bern itself, really. But it lasts 3 days. And it starts on a Thursday evening with the bear being freed. This is a man in a bear costume, by the way, not a real bear, being freed from the prison tower, which is one of the main towers in the center of the city. And that's the start of Carnival. And then there's processions over the next 3 days and obviously lots of music and street stalls and food. And it's fun. It's not fun in the rain. It's fun even in the snow. It's kind of atmospheric, but on a nice sunny day, lots of people in fancy dress, lots of floats and the main procession, lots of singing and dancing and bands and really things you don't expect the Swiss to do in public.
Yeah, okay. It sounds like a lot of fun.
It is fun. So, I mean, Basel is the most famous carnival in Switzerland. That's the huge one. They actually have a 3-day public holiday for the whole city, and it's vast. It's almost overwhelming, whereas Bern is much more sedate, but I quite enjoy it.
Okay. So apart from onions, are there any other culinary specialties of Bern that we should know about?
Well, there's one which I don't eat at all because I don't eat meat. It's called the Berner Teller or Berner Platter, and it's basically a whole plate of meat in every shape and form with potatoes on the side. So it's like pork chops and sausage and blood pudding and lots of things. My friends love it. I am not a big fan, as you can tell. I find it even hard to sit across the table from it. One of the nicest things that's come from the Bern region is a bread called the Zopf, which literally means plat. And it's a kind of milk bread, not sweet like a brioche, but milk. So it's quite moist and doughy. And it comes in a plat. And typically it's baked at the weekend. It's a weekend bread or a festival bread. And it's really lovely for brunch on a Sunday with honey on it. And rösti comes originally from Bern. So rösti is the grated fried potato dish. That was originally a farmer's dish from the farms of Emmental, which is just beside Bern. And very often you'll see it called Berner rösti, which is then has bacon added, usually. So it's always comfort food. It's not light on the whole, but I quite like it, especially in winter. And obviously we have fondue and raclette, like every Swiss town, even though they're not Bernese. They came from the French-speaking part of Switzerland. But I like that. And, of course, the biggest contribution Bern has made to world cuisine is Toblerone, which was invented in Bern. And there's still only one Toblerone factory in the whole world, and that is in Bern. So every triangle of Toblerone you see in every duty-free shop around the world has been made in Bern and shipped out there. Also, the other part, if we're talking about chocolate, I just have to throw in the fact that Mr. Lindt, Rudolf Lindt, was Bernese, one of the most famous names in Swiss chocolate, and he had his original factory here in Bern, and he was the one who took the milk chocolate that was invented in 1875 that we've already mentioned and made it the chocolate we know today, because milk chocolate originally was quite grainy, because cocoa butter is quite grainy, and Lindt developed the process called conching, which makes it that smooth, lovely lusciousness that we enjoy today. So without Mr. Lindt, a Bernese man, I don't think chocolate would have been the success story it is.
Okay. Well, I know that you proclaim to be a bit of a chocolate expert or a Swiss chocolate expert, and that, yeah, that probably deserves a whole episode in itself. But do you have a favourite Swiss chocolate?
Oh, that's a really hard question. That's like asking a mother who's their favourite child. If I'm honest, I could say I don't have a favourite because I like it all. There's no such thing as bad Swiss chocolate. Even if you buy the supermarket owned brand, which is a quarter of the price of the branded stuff, it's really good chocolate. What I have discovered is that when I lived in Britain, I grew up on dairy milk and the British chocolate, which is slightly less sweet, slightly less creamy than Swiss milk chocolate. And here I've discovered that I like dark chocolate, which I never liked before. But dark chocolate here is quite refined, and it comes in quite thin bars, and so it has that snap, and it's not a big chunk. And so you just appreciate it in a different way. So I've really got to like 70% dark chocolate. And the brand I guess I like most of all is the one which is rarely exported. It's kind of the one the Swiss keep for themselves. It's called Caille, C-A-I-L-L-E-R. And it's actually the oldest brand in Switzerland. It goes back to 1819. They just celebrated their 200 years. And Monsieur Caille was the father-in-law of the man who invented milk chocolate. That's how Daniel Peter came to invent milk chocolate. He already had chocolate in the family. But it, in those days, it was a dark chocolate, usually mixed with milk and sugar as a hot drink. And so Caille is one of those amazing brands that when you come here, it's everywhere. And it's one that you hardly ever see abroad, unlike Lindt, which is everywhere these days. So I like Caille. I like the fact that it's one of the historic brands and that they also make, they're the only, as far as I know, they're the only milk chocolate company that still makes chocolate not using powdered milk, so using real milk or condensed milk. But basically, you can eat any chocolate in Switzerland, and it's amazing, apart from white chocolate, of course, which isn't chocolate at all, really. It's Frankenstein chocolate. So, and I can say that because Frankenstein was Swiss as well. Mary Shelley. Mary Shelley wrote it while she was, started writing it while she was here in Switzerland. And Victor Frankenstein, the title character, comes from Geneva. Everyone forgets the Swiss connection of Frankenstein. But white chocolate is not chocolate, and no one should eat it. There we are.
Wow, you are a wealth of Swiss information. Well, it's been fantastic talking to you today. Where can our listeners find you online to get more info about your books and your career?
Well, luckily I have a very unusual name. So if you Google me, I pop up. I'm not John Smith, which is very fortunate for me. So dickandviews.com, so myname.com is where I have all the information about my books and me, but also a monthly, well, try to be monthly blog. I also do hotel reviews, and I'm on Twitter as Dick and B. I'm on Facebook as Swiss Watching. I'm on Instagram as Dick and Views. So you can find me everywhere. Some channels I actually use more often because I remember to use them. And then I write every now and then on my website, and, There's 10 years of articles there, 10 years of blog posts. So you can search through and find out about Swiss cemeteries or find out about how the Red Cross was founded or things like that. And of course, you can just email me and ask questions.
Fantastic. Well, I'll link to or mention all those websites and social media handles so that people can link through. And that will be in the show notes for this episode, which will be at holidaystoswitzerland.com/episode32. Thank you again, Dickon. It's been wonderful speaking to you.
Thank you for asking me. It's been fun.
Well, I've certainly just learnt some new facts about Switzerland from Dickon, both in this interview and from his book, Slow Train to Switzerland. I'm sure his other 6 books are full of useful and interesting information too, so I better get a copy of those. Would you like to win a copy of one of Dickon's books? Head to the show notes for this episode at holidaystoswitzerland.com/episode32, where you'll find out how to enter a competition to win a book of your choice from Dickon's collection. There's a simple question to answer, and that's it. Also in the show notes, you'll find details on where to purchase Dickens' books, as well as a link to his blog and social media channels. Thanks again for listening to the Holidays to Switzerland Travel Podcast. If there's a Swiss topic or destination you'd like covered in a future episode of the podcast, feel free to comment on the Holidays to Switzerland social media pages or drop me an email at hello@holidaystoswitzerland.com. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, tschüss!
Thank you so much for listening. For more great resources on planning a trip to Switzerland, make sure you visit holidaystoswitzerland.com, where you'll find trip planning tips, destination guides, information on transport, including Swiss rail passes, and much more. You're also encouraged to join the Switzerland Travel Planning Group on Facebook, where you can ask questions and chat to other past and future travellers to Switzerland. You'll find show notes from today's episode at holidaystoswitzerland.com/podcast, and be sure to subscribe to the Holidays to Switzerland Travel Podcast so you never miss an episode.